thank you guys for allowing me to come here. I have to say, you know, I've given talks at SOSP. I teach grads, undergrads, PhD students, and when they invited me to give a talk to an audience of sysadmins, I was basically terrified. I don't know that there is a tougher audience, so I will attempt to not disgust you by doing weather analogies ad nauseum as I take you through some of the things that we've been thinking about at Cal Berkeley in terms of cloud computing, which, for better or worse, is a new buzzword that you're not going to stop hearing for some time. Let me say a little about how we got into this and what we do. The RAD Lab, which is the Reliable Adaptive Distributed Systems Lab, is the chunk of the Berkeley CS department that I spend most of my time in. I work there with Dave Patterson, Randy Katz, Mike Jordan, a handful of other people. And kind of the motivation for the lab was this idea that, especially in the last decade or so, really instead of talking about servers, you're talking about data centers. In terms of talking about programming, it's no longer programming an application on a server. It's programming something like web search or email, which requires hundreds or thousands of servers. So the computer really is now thousands of computers, many racks interconnected by storage. It could be stored in a big building, or it could be stored in any number of these new data center ideas that, if you've been following the news, you've seen, you know, floating data centers made out of trailers, data centers in tents. Get it? Intense computing. The Rad Lab's idea is, how do you enable innovation in the kinds of services that take advantage of this infrastructure without first having to build and capitalize a company on the scale of Google or Amazon or Microsoft in order to do that? So the five-year moonshot statement for the Rad Lab is, could we enable a single person to develop, deploy, and operate at scale a next-gen internet application? We kind of like this anecdote that Pierre Omidyar, who founded eBay, wrote the prototype for eBay sort of over a long weekend. And eBay has pretty much changed the internet, but at the cost of sort of doing two or three rewrites every time they ran into a scaling barrier. So we believe that we can use, among other things, statistical machine learning as a key enabling technology to automate a lot of the problems that come with managing and scaling up these data centers, everything from developing the application through analyzing it through operations and deployment. And we put together a pretty exciting group of people, seven faculty in areas spanning systems through theory, a small army of PhD students accompanied by a number of very capable undergrads, one plus epsilon sysadmins, depending on what time you come into the lab. And we're very fortunate to have a lot of industrial affiliates, not just because the bottom dropped out of government funding for CS during the last 8 years, but because engagement with industry keeps us from smoking our own dope, as I like to say. It tries to keep us often honest about working on problems that are actually relevant and that somebody would actually care if we made progress on them. So we had been working on this five-year mission, so to speak, since about 2006. And the way that we got from that mission statement into cloud computing was, we have this theme that statistical machine learning is kind of undergoing this renaissance. There's a lot of really interesting cutting-edge techniques for pattern recognition, anomaly detection, and so forth. And we have found, in terms of experiment, that there are data center-related problems that these techniques do very well on, where simpler techniques that were used in the past don't do so well. So some problems that we've published good results on are resource utilization. If more people start to use this feature of my web service, does that mean that I'm going to need more CPU, more disk, more RAM, and in what proportions? Adding or removing storage bricks. I have an SLA on a storage system that I'm trying to meet, and depending on workload, I might need to add or subtract storage bricks. That means I need to copy data around. How do I model that? Console log analysis. I have these programs spewing out gigabytes of console logs a day. Can I mine those logs to find interesting information from stuff that I couldn't get from instrumentation? So we were very excited. We were doing all this stuff, and the feedback that we would get at our semi-annual meeting with our sponsors was, that's great work, guys. Now all you have to do is show that it works on thousands of machines, and we'll believe that you're actually making a contribution. And for a university, that's kind of a tall challenge. When I was a PhD student, we did results on the network of workstations, which at the time was around 100 machines, and that was really big for a university. That was kind of in the late 1990s. So, hearing our sponsors say, show us a demo on thousands of machines was daunting. And then, of course, utility computing came to the rescue. Amazon announced the Elastic Compute Cloud, EC2. They initially announced that you could rent servers for 10 cents an hour up to 80 cents an hour. They have since, as of last week, they've dropped those prices by about 15%. They talk about renting compute units, which are sort of a 1 gigahertz Opteron equivalent in 2007, plus or minus. And their original pricing, which is summarized in the table, basically shows that depending on what you pay per hour, you could get different CPU number of units or virtual cores, a different amount of storage capacity, a number of disk spindles, and they've now expanded this list. So there's a whole kind of one from column A, two from column B of how you can provision your instances. It's true pay-as-you-go, so there's no minimum cost. They also sell storage for 15 cents per gig per month. You can get network bandwidth inbound and outbound from their data center. You pay by the gigabyte. Internal bandwidth between the storage and the compute farm is free. And everything is virtualized. Interestingly, even the concept of independent failure is virtualized through what they call availability zones. You can ask to have two things put in different availability zones, meaning that they share little enough physical infrastructure that they'll probably fail separately. It's not the same as telling you where they are. They really go out of their way to try to, you know, virtualize and obfuscate as much of the physical topology as they can. But it's a pretty interesting setup. And we started to use this, and we believe this would be an interesting path to actually doing what our sponsors said. Take our results and use this new cloud computing thing to show that they really work at scale. So I'll come back to that in a moment. Now, of course, the inevitable result of this announcement and the subsequent high noise level in the blogosphere was that everybody felt the need to comment on cloud computing. Two favorite quotes that we've been using, one of them is from the illustrious Larry Ellison, who basically thinks that this is a crock, and that cloud computing really is just about redefining how you write your advertisements, that there's no technologically new thing going on here. It's just a matter of marketing and positioning. He said that a little more than a year ago. And somewhat more recently, Vivek Kundra, who is now the federal CIO for the United States, had a much more positive view. He said, we've been building all these data centers, doing all these separate applications. We need to find a more cost-effective way to do this. So amidst the hype and the noise in the blogosphere, how do you sort out what's actually new? Or, you know, is this just another fad that's going to fizzle out? And we took a crack at doing this. We had, about several months ago, I guess, we put together a white paper, a presentation. We had a little, we have a blog, a little video. It's very nice. Go to abovetheclouds.cs and you can check it out. But the goal was to try to, you know, really come down to have some good concrete discussions around what's really new here, if anything is in fact new. Clarifying some of the terminology, because people tend to, you know, when people say cloud, what do they actually mean? Quantify some comparisons between cloud versus conventional or non-cloud computing. And if we think cloud computing is something new, and if it's worth pursuing, what are the challenges and opportunities associated with doing that? And what role does research have to play? What role does industry have to play? And we actually believed that despite all of the existing noise, we might be able to add some value to the discussion. Berkeley has a strong systems tradition. Part of that is because we historically have had good engagement with industry, and that's, I think, a really important part of our identity. But at the same time, we didn't have an axe to grind. We don't have a product to sell. We don't have any vested interest in having any of these companies succeed or not, except to the extent that if they do succeed, we can go ask them for money to fund our research. And we have been using cloud computing in our research since about a year and a half ago. So we thought this might put us in an interesting position to try to bring, you know, a little bit of order and terminology clarification. So that's kind of that's the framing. What the rest of this talk is going to be about is, first of all, to address this question. Is there actually anything new in cloud computing? And if so, what is it and why should we care about it? What opportunities does it present? And what are the challenges to taking advantage of those opportunities? And then a third point, I'm not going to claim to answer this question, but one of the things that was sort of really irritating in the literature is, you know, you'd sort of hear company after company saying, oh, cloud computing is great. We're going to run our internal data center just like a cloud. And I can't help but wonder if that's the kind of question that some people who attend LISA might be getting. So I'm hoping that to some extent, some of the clarification that we're going to try to do may help find a way to answer this question. And I'll talk about our own experience as academics using the cloud for research, for teaching, and more recently, the UC system has been talking about what ways should we look for UC system-wide to exploit cloud computing, not just for research and instruction, but for administrative things, and for other departments that are not sort of IT-heavy departments. So that's where we're going, and we'll start right in with, you know, what is actually new about cloud computing. Let's start with what's not new. Software as a service is not new, and a lot of the early noise about cloud computing, I think, really conflated the concept of software as a service with what Amazon was calling a cloud. The software as a service idea is, you know, older than I am, and that's, you know, that's saying something, I guess. I'm not as young as I used to be. But there is something that is new about the way that it's being offered. It's really truly pay-as-you-go utility computing. And if you go back to the Multic stuff, you can find the vision of something like this. But this is really the first time that we think it's happened at the scale and at the level of accessibility that was envisioned that time. It's, first of all, you get the illusion as a user of cloud computing of infinite resources on demand for small values of infinite. And on demand means that you can get those resources provisioned in minutes, right? Not weeks to acquire equipment or rack it, but really 5 minutes. You get really fine-grained billing. So the granularity is basically once an hour for compute units, but the cost per hour is so low that it's effectively continuous. And as soon as you release something, some resource, you're not paying for that resource anymore. So if I release a server, I'm not paying for it as of, you know, no more than an hour out after I release it. There's no minimum commitment. I actually help a couple of nonprofits that maintain small MySQL-backed websites. They have, you know, on the order of a few gigabytes of data that, you know, we gzip it every night. I just shove it over to Amazon S3, and every month I get a bill by email for like 43 cents or something. Amazon has found a way to make a business model out of a lot of people paying 43 cents a month, which, when you think about it, they came from a commodity retail culture. So I sort of understand how they managed to get there. There were earlier examples of this. In the last decade or so, Sun and Intel each tried to offer something like a compute service. But in both of those cases, there was a longer commitment required, so it wasn't really pay-as-you-go. It was definitely more expensive per hour by an order of magnitude or more. And they didn't really have a good story for storage, which we can come back to, but Amazon actually now has a few different solutions for that. So with that framing, let me do a very quick cloud economics 101. And if this is review for you, hang out or read your email or something. But just to make sure that we're all on the same page, why did people get excited when cloud computing was announced? If you're a cloud computing user and you're providing a user-facing service that has a non-trivial ratio of average to peak demand, then it's pretty clear that if you are provisioning to meet your SLA at the peak of demand, then at all other times you're wasting capacity, you're leaving it on the table. And in principle, if you can do this fine-grained grab and release, you should be able to have your actual capacity that's provisioned closely track your demand, right? Modulo how well you can figure out what your demand is. And by the way, this is kind of the obvious story for a user, but if you're the operator of a data center, if you're a cloud computing provider like Amazon or like Microsoft Azure, there's an opportunity to save energy, right? You can potentially, by consolidation and turning off machines that are not actually in use by your customers, you could actually reduce one of the direct costs of running your data center, which is, as we all know, is becoming one of the dominant costs of running a data center. So both from the user's and the provider's point of view, there's at least in principle an opportunity to match your consumption to your actual demand. If you kind of do a back of the envelope, you know, in terms of server hardware costs, what might this actually save you? Most of these statistics are in our paper, and they're pretty well backed up by people who know much more about this than we do, but server utilization across enterprise data centers and production data centers is not great. 5 to 20% is typical, and 20% is actually pretty good. And for a lot of these user-facing interactive services, it's not uncommon for the peaks to be anywhere from 2 to 10x the average utilization or the average demand. So if you figure out what's the cost per hour to use a server in the cloud, well, for Amazon, it starts at 8.5 cents per hour. What's the cost per hour if you buy a server? Under reasonable assumptions, you might say something like, it costs $2,000 and I'll depreciate it over 3 years. So you get a number that's kind of in the same ballpark, 7.5 cents an hour. So basically, but to the extent that the ratio of your peak to average utilization exceeds the ratio of those costs, at least in principle, there is money to be saved, right? So in this simple example, the peak only has to be 1.1x more than the average, and typically, in fact, peaks are much, much larger than that compared to the average. Now, of course, you also have to factor in the cost of networking, inbound and outbound. You have to factor in your storage costs. But in cloud computing, Amazon has actually quantified those, right? They know what it will cost them to sell you a CPU hour, a gigabyte month, or a gigabit per second over some number of bytes. And you can actually, if you know your utilization, you could write those numbers down and you can do the calculation. The tricky part is that accounting on the IT side when you're not in the cloud is a lot less simple. So, you know, even a trivial example, like at UC Berkeley, all departments pay general overheads related to things like physical plant, electricity, administrative costs that go across departmental boundaries. It's not always easy to tease out what part of the IT costs are wrapped up in those bundled things. And that's one of the themes that we'll come back to when we get to, you know, should I cloudify my data center or my cluster or whatever? If one of the reasons for doing it is that you think you can save money, step zero is to figure out what costs you're incurring now. And it turns out that that actually can be pretty hard. So let me show this rather obvious picture because I'm going somewhere with it. The previous picture was if you have a pretty good handle on what your peak is. If you're a startup, you might actually not have a good handle on what your peak is, and you basically have to make a bet. If you bet that your peak is going to be pretty high and it turns out that you're wrong, then in some sense what you've left on the table is even more unused resources, right? Even at peak, you've got capacity left on the table because you bought servers, you racked them, and you're paying for the data center. If you guess on the low end, there's kind of two different bad things that can happen. One bad thing is you have some fraction of users above the red line in the upper right diagram who are always unhappy because you can't serve them. You just don't have enough capacity when the peaks come. Another possibility, which is arguably worse, is that you have some users who are sufficiently pissed off that some fraction of them don't come back, and that sort of keeps going until it kind of levels out. And there's documented examples of both of these cases happening to different companies at different times. So the risks of guessing wrong is really what this is trying to get at. And that's why pretty early on in putting together our tech report, we had heard all these people talk about the big shift in cloud computing is CapEx versus OpEx. You know, instead of a capital expense, you can now write off your computing as an operating expense. That's true, but we think that maybe misses the point. What we actually think is more important is that it's the transference of risk, and specifically the risk of having to make decisions about provisioning where you don't know very much in advance. An economist friend of ours, when we were talking this over with him, said, you know, CapEx versus OpEx is not really the point, because over a sufficiently long time scale, a dollar is a dollar. Whether you spent it on buying a server or you spent it on renting a server, it's still the same amount of money. And in fact, if you know what your capacity is, you could do some simple arithmetic and show that cloud computing probably won't save you money, right? If your capacity doesn't vary very much and you have a good handle on what it is, it usually is cheaper to own your own servers. But when you don't know what that is, the idea that you can transfer the risk of guessing from yourself to the cloud provider actually does open up new opportunities. So this is the first thing we think is actually new about cloud computing. These are scenarios that, without risk transference, it's not realistic to think about doing them. So one of these scenarios is what we call, informally call, cost associative, right? It means that I can get 1,000 servers for an hour for the same amount of money as getting a single server for 1,000 hours. And by the way, it takes just about as long to provision the 1,000 as it does to provision the one server. So that's really new. I mean, certainly as an academic, there's no previous scenario where we could have done any of that. And one of the very early kind of media stories about this was that when Hillary Clinton's travel documents were released, the Washington Post was able to make them available on the web within a day, and it's because they harnessed sort of some arbitrarily large number of Amazon EC2 servers to do the conversion by batch, right? That nice, embarrassingly parallel job. But the idea that if your job is embarrassingly parallel, you can now solve it in an amount of time that's inversely proportional to what you're willing to spend, that's really new. That didn't exist before. As researchers in the Rad Lab, it means that we can write conference papers and publish results based on a 1,000 server cluster. I mean, that's unthinkable for a university to have ever really been able to do that. You know, like I said, the largest university experiments I know of, even you know, people who reported on things with Planet Lab and Emulab, we're talking about hundreds of nodes, maybe. 1,000 and the fact that you can do multiple experiments, right? It's not just you have 1,000 nodes and once your reservation's over, you lose the nodes. You have 1,000 nodes, and if you screw it up, you can just pay for another 1,000. So we'll come back to this as well, but this risk transfer thing, it's not necessarily just about saving money. There's new stuff you can do that you couldn't do before, and that may actually be worth more money to you in certain cases. For obvious reasons, then, you can see that this is a major enabler for startups that don't know how popular they're going to be. Animoto, I know it's kind of one of Amazon's favorite poster children for cloud computing. They have this, I don't know if anybody's ever used it, they have this little app where you can upload photos and it makes a little music video out of them. It's the kind of thing where you'd think, oh, you know, how popular can this possibly get? And the answer is that they did a Facebook plugin and, you know, over the next 3 days, every 12 hours, the number of users they had would double. Again, that's not a scenario. You know, it's hard to imagine the Animoto founders going to their investors and saying, we think that this is going to be so popular that we're going to have doubling of our load every 12 hours for 3 days, right? And even if they had said that, it takes a certain amount of time to provision that amount of capacity. They went from about 50 servers to about 3,500 servers. So, you know, wow, hooray for cloud computing. What I think is more interesting is that after the initial honeymoon was over and the app was not sort of as popular anymore, they scaled back down. Right, so the idea that they were able to, you know, there's really two risks that he transferred. One of them is the risk of having to guess what their peak would be and be able to serve all these people without turning them away. But the second one was knowing what their steady state was going to be after the peak was over. Right, there's not really, wasn't really a clean way to handle that before this. So the idea that you can transfer this risk from yourself to the cloud provider really enables you to do some stuff that, as far as we can tell, this is a genuinely new capability. So a natural question that arises is, well, you know, if this is really true, right? If this is a new opportunity, why is it new now? Why wasn't this happening a few years ago? And it took us a while to kind of get our heads around this, but one of the things we kept coming back to over and over again is that we've seen a build-out in the last decade of data centers at a building pace and at a scale that really is unprecedented. Even by the standards of this field, which is sort of everything about this field is like up and to the right all the time, but tens of thousands of commodity PCs with many data centers per year going up, the rate and scale of this build-out is really extreme. And not only the physical data centers, but the expertise in how you run something of that size. So that means you have to understand infrastructure software at the scale of something like GFS. You have to develop the operational experience to do data center scale failover, to handle the various kinds of attacks that evil people throw at you, to operate firewalls. And if you read, James Hamilton has done really some of the best writing and reporting, I think, on data centers. If you're really provisioning at this scale and at this rate, your buying power can get you an economy of scale where you'll be paying 5 to 7 times less for everything, for hardware, for bandwidth, for power, than if you were provisioning medium-sized data centers. So there is a fundamental economy of scale argument that comes out of the fact that companies like Google and Amazon and eBay were doing this build-out not because they wanted to get into cloud computing, but because their business needs were driving it, right? They had business plans in place for how these data centers were going to be used, but the economy of scale that made them that much cheaper now allows a company like Amazon to turn around and sell it for what appears to be a low sticker price and actually still find a way to make something out of that transaction. So that was pretty new. There were other factors that we identified, and like I said, the paper goes into more detail about just about everything I'm talking about today. These factors ultimately got demoted to the category of necessary but not sufficient. Having the broadband internet be a lot more pervasive than it was 10 years ago is important because you have peering, you have a community of users that is sort of growing all the time to consume the services you're providing. Hardware, you know, I don't know if it was obvious 10 years ago that the x86 was going to sort of sweep away everything in its path, but that has clearly happened, and with fast virtualization like you get with Zen and VMware, the idea of statistically multiplexing people onto x86 hardware becomes practical, right? It's not just the virtualization, it's that everyone wants to buy the same underlying commodity, and that wasn't necessarily obvious a decade ago, at least to some of us who are short-sighted like me. And the fact that free software has just become amazingly, amazingly powerful. What you can build starting out entirely with free and open source software is, at least to me, is just astonishing, even compared to 10 or 15 years ago. So I think if any of these factors had been absent, we wouldn't have this, you know, this new phenomenon. But at the end of the day, it's the economy of scale and the fact that we're, you know, all of a sudden building things orders of magnitude larger than had been done before, that's really what ended up being the main driver. So with that as background, let me get into the second section, which is, given that, you know, if you buy that there is in fact something new here and that there are some interesting things, opportunities that are opened up as a result, the next natural question is, what are the challenges that go along with those opportunities and what should we, the community, be doing about them? Because of limits of time, obviously, I'm not going to talk about all the challenges that we identified in the paper. I think we had 10 because you have to have a top 10 list. Otherwise, no one, you know, the top 11 list doesn't sound very glamorous. I'm going to talk about like 3 or 4 of them, but again, I encourage you to read the paper and send us feedback and check out our blog and interact with us and stuff. Some of the obstacles are straight ahead technical obstacles that come out of this new accessibility of large scale to everybody. Some of them are non-technical. They're administrative, policy, or licensing obstacles that, although not necessarily obvious, could be just as much of a deal breaker in some cases. So let's look at a couple of these. In order to position the discussion about these obstacles, let me just point out that cloud computing has now come to mean a range of things, and one really simple axis that you can use to classify them is essentially what level of abstraction you're given as a user to program against. So kind of at one extreme of that scale is Amazon EC2. What you're buying is a virtualized x86 ISA core or some number of cores. You're free to do more or less anything you want. You can run any kernel that's Zen-friendly. You can install your own wacko libraries. You can write your own software for load balancing failover. It's wide open, which is both good and bad. Another extreme at the far right, something like Google App Engine or Force.com, which is Salesforce's hosted application platform. Those frameworks say this is the way you write your app. Your app has to have this structure, and it has these very rigid constraints. So, for example, in App Engine, your app has to look like a request reply-based web app. There are hard bounds on how long your app can compute before it gets kicked off and another app gets swapped in. But if you can make your app fit that shoehorn, we have all of this operational stuff that we've done for you. We do automatic scaling. Because we know what assumptions your app is allowed to make about storage, we can actually make replication decisions for you. We can handle all this great stuff that you otherwise would have to build yourself. And then somewhere in between are things like Microsoft Azure, which is announced more recently, which is a managed runtime virtual machine based on CLR, and there's a bunch of tools and services that you can use that go along with that. But the real issue is this trade-off of flexibility and portability versus built-in functionality, right? At the Amazon extreme, a very common pattern is start your own Ubuntu image, install a LAMP stack on it, install a bunch of other stuff, and then you're off and running. At the App Engine extreme, there's a lot less that you have to do, right? You really are just almost writing handlers. But the reason that this becomes important, besides the fact that the stuff on the right, although more restrictive, is potentially easier to program, is that it implicitly makes you dependent on the other infrastructure software. So that kind of brings us into our first couple of obstacles. We spent a lot of time talking to our industrial colleagues about this too, to find out what they lose sleep over and why, you know, what would make them nervous about buying into cloud computing, so to speak. The number one thing that always came up came down to business continuity. If the data center has a problem and your stuff is all in one data center, we already know that's kind of, you know, you have a single point of failure. Now there's also an administrative single point of failure, which is that your cloud computing provider becomes unfriendly. They decide that they're, you know, they really should be your competitor and not your vendor, or they go out of business, or they're acquired by someone. So really the only way to avoid a single point of failure is for there to be multiple data centers, and really ideally multiple cloud computing providers, because you need to avoid single points of failure both from an administrative business point of view as well as from a technical point of view. Although there were, you know, there was a lot of noise about availability in the sense of how many nines, right, what's the uptime, and the outages in EC2 and Google App Engine were widely publicized. I would be willing to bet, since, you know, it's hard to get availability numbers out of enterprise data centers, but I don't think most enterprise data centers' availability is as good as EC2 has been over its lifetime. Setting that aside, the other issue, and this is when Richard Stallman was asked about cloud computing early on, I think is what he was trying to say, is if you're using these higher level clouds like App Engine or Force.com, the proprietary software that they use to do their operations essentially becomes another single point of failure for you, because now your app becomes dependent on it, and it's not clear that you could extract it and move it to a different cloud computing provider unless there was something that was at least API compatible in terms of the infrastructure services that you came to rely upon. Happily, the open source community is coming to the rescue on this. There's already something, a project underway called AppScale, which is an open source API compatible re-implementation of Google App Engine. There's numerous storage systems, which I'll touch on briefly in other slides. But the main message here is that single point of failure is now not just a technical obstacle, it's potentially a business obstacle as well. Related to that is data lock-in. If I'm putting all my data into one of these cloud services, even if there's not proprietary software that I'm relying on, am I now locked in because they're storing my data in a proprietary format or otherwise making it difficult for me to get my data out? Again, happily, the open source community has started doing re-implementations of popular abstractions like Hypertable. Hypertable is built to kind of look like Google Bigtable, which is the backing store used for things like MapReduce. More interestingly, a couple of weeks ago, there's a project announced called the Data Liberation Front. It's actually run by a group of Google engineers whose goal is to make it as easy as possible for you to get data out of any cloud and into another cloud. So open formats, a commitment to not charging you extortionist fees for getting your data in and out. So this is brand new, but I think it's sort of heading in the right direction, and it'll be interesting to see where it goes. Even if there's not an issue with proprietary data formats or sort of extracting your data from the cloud, there is the issue that data is just expensive to move around. In fact, if you kind of look at the cost structure of Amazon EC2, by far the relatively most expensive thing is moving data in and out across their data center boundaries. Once you're inside their infrastructure, data transfer is free, but it's about 15 cents, anywhere from 10 to 15 cents a gigabyte across the data center boundary, and it adds up pretty fast. And one of the things we proposed early on in our paper is, well, if you're really generating, a terabyte of data per day or something like that, if you're doing big science and you want to use cloud computing to operate on your data, you could just put all your disks in a big FedEx box and ship that box to the cloud provider's data center. And you know, people thought that was pretty stupid, and Amazon now provides that service. So I don't know if maybe they didn't think it was stupid, but there's you can send them a disk, and for a fixed amount of money that is much less than what it would cost for you to transfer it over the network, they'll basically rack your disk. And by the way, they're also generously hosting free public data sets, which attract cycles, right? So a lot of the government data that's on data.gov, there are mirrors of some of that stuff on Amazon, and if you want to write apps that use that data, you don't have to pay for any kind of access to the data. Of course, you're paying for the cycles that you will crunch in using the data. So you know, it's interesting point of view from a company that came out of retail of how to monetize this idea that the data sort of sucks everything to itself. Maybe a less obvious thing about data being a gravity well, and if depending on how we're doing on time, I may try to come back to this. In the database literature, you know, over 20 plus years, the idea of scaling up a database as your data set gets bigger or as your demand goes up is a sort of recurring theme. The theme you haven't really seen is scaling down. So the Animoto example kind of brought this to light, right? It's great to be able to scale up, but unless you expect to be that popular forever, you probably will have to scale down eventually. And in fact, most services that have something like a diurnal variation, you could make an argument that there's money to be saved if you could do scale up and scale down on the granularity of hours rather than on the granularity of days or weeks. And there isn't really anything out there that speaks to this directly. This is actually, a bona fide research opportunity. And not coincidentally, we are in the Rad Lab doing some research on it. And if time permits, I'll show you a little animated movie showing one of the things that we're working on. But the idea that you could save money by scaling down is I think, a new idea for data. And one of the side effects is that you're starting to see a proliferation of non-relational scalable storage. Basically, at the point where a large MySQL installation runs out of steam, almost every company that has had to build beyond that point has ended up building some one-off thing to do it. And they're all variants of key value stores of some kind. So this is a smattering of projects that you can go off and look at. There's now a movement called NoSQL, a group of people who meet pretty regularly in Oakland to talk about what could you do with non-relational data stores. But there's a whole new landscape of interesting data storage related issues in the cloud. And one of them is this idea of scaling down as well as up. So that was a subset of some technical challenges. What about policy-related or business challenges? One of the ones that we thought would be important was this idea of reputation fate sharing, that if your apps are in a public cloud with somebody else's apps who is evil, then because of the technical machinery by which reputation guarding is now done, your reputation could be very easily soiled by being next to someone evil. And in fact, in April, this really happened. A couple of months after we wrote the paper, the FBI raided a data center in Dallas because there was, in fact, a company there that was the target of an investigation about suspected criminal activity. But the FBI sort of took a heavy-handed approach. They shut down a large chunk of the data center. A number of the companies that were hosted along with them basically went out of business. They never recovered. So the way we put this in the paper is reputations don't virtualize as well as some other things. And we thought, you know, how would you get around that? Well, there's already email houses that do things like maintain relationships with ISPs to whitelist their SMTP servers. They use all the authentication you're supposed to use. And in fact, Amazon started doing this, I think, just last week. For a fee, they will whitelist your Elastic IP addresses and allow you to selectively raise the quota that they set on outgoing SMTP from your EC2 instances. So it's basically a way of recognizing that, you know, again, if you're trying to virtualize, you really have to virtualize everything. How do you virtualize the concept of being trustworthy even though you're sharing public infrastructure with untrustworthy people? Well, you put mechanisms in place to do things like whitelisting, and you find a way to charge differentially for that. So we thought that was pretty interesting. Another, you know, policy or business-related challenge, most software licensing is not what you'd call cloud-friendly. Typically, it's still based on per-seat or site kind of licenses. In contrast to the cloud resources, which are purely pay-as-you-go, now, shortly, I think literally a week after we did the paper, IBM announced that they were going to start offering pay-as-you-go IBM WebSphere stack products on EC2. And the way it works is that instead of paying whatever the base rate is per machine, you would pay a higher base rate, and you'd get a machine that already had this software installed, and you'd get to configure it and stuff like that. But what was interesting is that it was really pay-as-you-go. So if you scaled up the number of app servers and then scaled it down during the day, you would really just be paid for the time you used, modulo hourly billing. So pay-as-you-go licenses clearly are one solution. Another solution you might imagine is something like a bulk license, where we would buy some number of CPU hours, let's say, for a license to something like MATLAB, and it's up to us how we choose to spend those CPU hours. We could either run very long jobs on a small number of machines, or we could run a very parallel job that runs for a shorter time, but you'd sort of have this debit card where it runs out of the license pool. And in fact, that's roughly, you know, we have a very good relationship with Amazon. They've been kind enough to donate EC2 credits for us to use in our research, and that's basically how it works. They give us a lump of essentially funny money, and we're being charged by the CPU hour, so it's, you know, whether we run a few big experiments or a lot of small ones. There's also, for a long time now, Windows has been available on EC2. You can boot Windows images rather than various flavors of Linux, and you pay a premium for that. Depending on who you are, this may or may not be a huge obstacle for you. If you're a startup or if you're an academic research, the open source software is so good that this may be a non-issue. But if you're relying on Windows or if you're relying on technology stacks that are payware licenses, and you'd like to find a way to move those to the cloud, then this is something you have to deal with. And we're starting to see companies slowly moving in this direction. So with that as a subset of some of the challenges and opportunities, let's turn to this general question of, should I cloudify, whatever that means, right? So I have my private data center, my enterprise data center, maybe I have a number of them spread across different locations, and I've heard that cloud computing is great, it could save us all this money, and you should go off and figure out how we're going to cloudify our operations, and then come back and tell me how much money we're going to save. I think it should be obvious from just some of the simple analyses that we've done so far that public and private clouds will not necessarily all get the same set of benefits, right? So based on these obstacles and opportunities, we could see that there's a number of distinct benefits that you could potentially get from cloud computing. And the question is, for the case of private versus public, do you always get the benefit? So kind of at the top of the list is this idea of economy of scale. It is unlikely that very many companies will be able to get the economy of scale that, for example, Amazon and Microsoft and Google have been able to get. They're just not big enough, right? And this factor of 5 to 7 is what allows the cost savings to be passed on to the end user and still have the cloud vendor be able to make a viable business out of it. So, you know, kind of step 0, 1, and 2 are how much, if you're really doing this to save money, how much are you looking to save, and is the expectation realistic? What about this idea of the resources on demand is infinite? EC2 is large enough that unless you're routinely recruiting thousands of nodes at a time, it's very unlikely that your request for more nodes will be turned back. So from, you know, as far as we've been able to tell, it is, you know, for all practical purposes, infinite. But this ratio of how many machines you need at a time to how large is your total pool of machines, it depends a lot on what kind of services you're providing, how large your data center is. For example, there's an operation within eBay where they provide analytics as a service. You can basically submit batch jobs to a virtual analytics queue, and they have essentially an internal cloud that runs the jobs for you. But the model there is that you're submitting jobs to a queue. It's not that you're asking for a certain fixed set of resources. So a lot about how you decide to architect the way you're going to present the cloud to your users will determine if you can actually get this infinite on demand. The idea of eliminating the upfront commitment by users, again, it's not clear. There's, you know, when Amazon got into the cloud computing business, they had already invested a lot in building data centers, and they had not necessarily done it for the purpose of going into this business. So the cost recovery model for how they're going to make money from the cloud might be somewhat different than if you started by building out for this specific purpose. And, you know, what about getting fine-grained pay-as-you-go? Well, you have to ask what that even means inside an organization, right? Some organizations are set up so that there's a very specific recharge model, for example, for using up IT resources, whether it's, you know, bytes on a disk or cycles on a CPU. In other organizations, the distinction is less clear. And the idea for, you know, pay-as-you-go is important because one of the claimed benefits of the cloud is that even if you don't get this economy of scale, you could be getting better utilization out of the hardware you do have. And our hypothesis is one of the reasons that this works, you know, in Amazon's case, for example, is that they give you a direct economic incentive to release the resources you're not using. If you release them, you're no longer paying for them. So there's a direct financial motivation to keep track of what you really need. And if you can't replicate that internally, it's not clear that you'll be able to get this better utilization, right? If you don't give people a reason to release the hardware, I don't think it's controversial to say that people need a reason to release hardware. If the default is that nothing bad happens when they hold on to the hardware, they will hold on to it for a long time. We see it in academia as well, and Amazon has basically as much as said that a lot of the technology that was productized as EC2 was developed internally to solve some of these same problems, right? Where they, before the holidays, they'd have to place this huge order of machines, and then the machines would just sort of get sat on for a long time. So, you know, to really get this benefit of statistical multiplexing a lot of people onto a smaller amount of hardware, you need to make sure that there's some incentive system in place for people to really release what they don't need to use. What about the idea that through virtual machine technology, you could simplify configuration and, you know, you might be able to improve your utilization by consolidating servers? I think that's pretty uncontroversial. If you can surmount some of the basic technical obstacles of virtualizing the apps you already have, you should be able to do this. We've done it. But you can make the case that that's not really a cloud computing argument. That's an argument about virtual machines are good, and we sort of knew that before clouds came along. So given that, you know, should I cloudify my application or my data center? Well, I think the first reason, the first thing to ask is, what's the reason for asking the question? Are you looking to cloudify because you think you're going to save money? Because if so, first of all, you're probably not going to get the economy of scale that the big players get. And second, unless you're very careful about how you're doing your cost accounting, you may end up double paying for bundled costs. So for example, a lot of the computing we've been doing in the Rad Lab at Berkeley, we've been using a lot of cycles on EC2. I mean, a lot. But we're still paying the same as we've always paid for the university overhead on power. Right? Now, to be perfectly honest, we probably, historically, we've used more than our share of power. So it probably comes out in the wash in my specific example. But the point is, when we pay Amazon for a server hour, that includes the power to run the server, the incremental cost of having administrators who look after the servers and, you know, change out broken disks and stuff. We're still paying the university all of those same costs, right? In that sense, it hasn't saved us any money. And as I'll come back to, the funding structures and chargeback structures have not at all caught up to this. So that's a separate can of worms. Assuming that you believe that you can avoid double paying for these bundled costs, and assuming that you can live without the huge economy of scale, do you have a system in place that incentivizes people to release the resources that they don't need? If you don't have such a system, you maybe shouldn't expect that you'll get better utilization, because if there's no reason to release hardware, why would you do so, right? If the goal is to multiplex more stuff onto less hardware and track your actual need, you have to have a way to measure actual need and penalize people who are holding on to more than what the actual need is. This is highly non-trivial. And we talked recently to Marvin Timer, who's in the cloud services division at Amazon. What's not obvious about this is that if you want to do this fine-grained pay-as-you-go, you have to be able to do metering at that granularity. You need a fair amount of instrumentation and infrastructure to actually do that billing, right? I mentioned at the beginning of my talk that in a typical month, I'll get a bill from Amazon for like 43 cents. So they've got enough instrumentation in place to figure out that they have to charge me 43 cents, and they can figure it out with basically zero human intervention in the process of computing that, and that they do that for a lot large number of users, most of whom probably are much, you know, much better customers than I am in some sense. But you have to be able to measure it, and you have to be able to somehow charge for it. If you can't do both of those things, you can't motivate people to lose what they don't need, and that's likely to get in the way of getting better utilization. What else happens? I had the good fortune to be able to talk to some of our Berkeley sysadmins about this, and one thing they all immediately agreed on unanimously is that this idea of IT best practices becomes, you know, if you'll pardon the phrase, it becomes no longer an academic question. It's one thing to, you know, you have standards for when should you encrypt stuff, how should you safeguard your passwords, you know, these sort of best practices kind of things. Inside the protected perimeter of UC Berkeley, you can kind of play fast and loose with some of those. I mean, I'm sure I don't follow all the best practices, but the reality is Berkeley has enough reasonable infrastructure that I'm still likely to be protected from a large number of threats. That's no longer true if I decide that I'm going to put my apps and my data into a public cloud. You know, there's really no protection anymore at that point. So the impact of not following best practices actually could be severe. And then you have to ask, well, people talk about, has security for cloud computing really been figured out? Well, it's not clear that the weakest link in the security chain for cloud computing is a technical link, right? It's already problematic to get people to follow best practices, and that may well turn out to be one of the reasons that someone will have a bad experience moving some of their proprietary apps or their sensitive apps into the cloud. Another issue that came up was the idea of support and lifecycle costs. There's a certain class of applications, things like hardware appliances, spam filters, mail servers, things like that, where it's not clear that if you factor in the overall lifecycle cost, including tech support, including administrative overhead, cognitive burden, that it's necessarily going to be better to cloudify those things. And some of these things, like spam filters, it's difficult to extract them cleanly from the rest of your infrastructure. So there may be chunks of your infrastructure that, A, are difficult to justify why you would ever cloudify them, and B, are tightly enough coupled to the rest of your infrastructure that it's hard to pull the rest of it off and cloudify that. Not to mention that there's also now this, one of my colleagues called the accountability gap for support. If something bad happens, whether it's an outage or whether it's something really bad like a data breach, whose responsibility is it? Who do you call? The Berkeley CIO's office has been having a lot of discussions about how they could use cloud computing around UC Berkeley, and this is the thing that always comes up. It's one thing to say, well, look, the students already use Gmail, they use Facebook, they're already sending sensitive information over public networks. What's the big deal? It's another thing to say Berkeley chooses to put this stuff in the public infrastructure, right? So a mishap could happen either way, but the consequences and who's accountable and whose networks did this flow over, that's quite different in both cases. And that's not really a technical obstacle. But IT best practices really become critical when you're talking about moving stuff into a public open environment. So one solution that a lot of people have looked at to sort of, could you get the best of both worlds, is what's variously been called hybrid computing or surge computing. It's a really simple idea. You have some of your own infrastructure, and you selectively overflow some things into the cloud. So what do you overflow? Well, one thing you could do is just take these separate one-off jobs that don't depend heavily on your infrastructure, and you could move those off, right? That's the New York Times doing Hillary Clinton's travel documents. A harder thing is if I really want to have the same set of apps or the same set of services and kind of seamlessly overflow onto the cloud when I need extra capacity, how do I do that? First of all, it means that you've already architected your apps to have a pretty good location independence. Your software really is modular. You still have to overcome most of those cloud obstacles. So, data availability, data formats, all the things that we mentioned, if you wanted to really go 100% cloud, you'll probably have to touch each one of those in considering whether to be able to overflow onto the cloud. And you have to decide whether you're going to use open source software like Eucalyptus or commercial products. VMware has been talking about products that will allow you to manage your data center as a cloud, but then, does that mean that it's API compatible with the public cloud, and would you be able to overflow to that? We actually have Eucalyptus running at Berkeley. I'll say a little bit about it in the next part of the talk. And we've been able to get this to work. We actually have an experimental setup and tool chain where we could sort of do the same stuff locally and then overflow it when we need to onto EC2. But it hasn't come without a cost, and there's a lot of things that we still can't do, and I'll come back to those in a moment. Do your applications make sense to cloudify? So some applications are sort of obvious candidates for taking advantage of this on-demand capability, right? There's already desktop applications that have extensions into the cloud. MATLAB allows you to run expensive computations in the cloud now, so does Mathematica. I'm pretty sure that it can't be long before the Microsoft productivity apps have a cloud backend. You can imagine sort of the Excel spreadsheet from hell that actually does all its computations in a really large data center. Web applications, that's kind of a no-brainer. If you have a reasonable strategy for having a database replica, you could maybe move your read-mostly stuff into the cloud. Batch processing is another good one, right? Hadoop, which is the open source implementation of MapReduce, has become hugely popular, and if you've got jobs that you can cast into that mold, that's a great candidate for running out in the cloud, because it's a standard software stack, it's a self-contained chunk of work that just happens to be embarrassingly parallel. Other types are not so clear what the benefit might be. Anything that involves bulk data movement is expensive and slow, so if you're generating a lot of science data, it's not clear that it makes sense to move all that science data into the cloud just to compute on it, right? The time and money savings that you're expecting to get from being embarrassingly parallel on cheap servers may largely evaporate in the time it takes to move the data and the money you pay to get it across the network, unless you FedEx your disks. If your applications are jitter sensitive, virtual machines already, they're known to have issues with the jitter sensitivity of I/O. There's also the long haul latency. If if your application relies on data that's stored back in your enterprise data center or in your university data center, so there's both sort of speed of light kind of speed of network issues, as well as virtualization induced noise. The virtualization noise is getting better. And as far as we're concerned, you have to be designing your apps to tolerate virtualization noise, because at one level or another, this is the way the world is going. But for the present, applications that are closely tuned to be jitter sensitive to the hardware may be difficult to move to the cloud. And we've done a bunch of micro benchmarks that basically show, unsurprisingly, that this is the case. So let me talk about some specific experiences we've had as academics trying to face some of these obstacles and kind of hoping to take advantage of some of these opportunities. I know that some people here are working in an academic environment. My hope is that something about what our experience has been may also have value for people who are in industrial environments. And let me extend my thanks a priori to the three sysadmins who, in some capacity or other, helped support the CS department labs that I work in. John Carota, who actually had a poster a couple of days ago. Some of you may have seen it. And then Eric Fraser and Mike Howard, colleagues of his. How are we using cloud computing in the Rad Lab? We run Eucalyptus. It's an open source, API-compatible cloud management layer, API-compatible to EC2, which means that all of the EC2 command line tools that Amazon provides work off the shelf. You just change a couple of environment variables, and it just works. So we have a local cluster. We also use a lot of Amazon AWS credits. Some of that is because Amazon's been nice enough to donate it, but they only, they did that because they realized we would get addicted and then be paying for it, which is just what's happened. Workload really does overflow from one to the other. So we use the same tools, the same VM images, the same scripts. All the same stuff really just works across the two environments. And we've used it primarily for research and experiments that we do as part of our machine learning meets systems vision. But the experiments don't necessarily have to tie in with campus resources, like, for example, a Kerberos authentication. And let me just say up front that there's this huge thicket of unsolved open problems as far as what happens when I try to run my service running inside Berkeley can mount Berkeley file servers. It can talk to the campus's authentication infrastructure and use Kerberos authenticated services. What happens to that when I move it over to EC2? And kind of the short answer is a lot of that stuff breaks. We don't really have a good answer to that. We're sort of still working on it. And I think kind of the next big frontier in surge computing is going to be figuring out both logistically and policy-wise how to get that right. So that's our setup. I should point out that everything I'm about to say is very electrical engineering, computer science centric, in that EECS is naturally an IT-heavy discipline because of experimentation. Just the nature of the work we do, we're big users of computing. Not all of this would necessarily be, I wouldn't be as excited necessarily if I was in some other engineering department, and if I was in a humanities department, then who knows. But having given that caveat, from our point of view, the biggest deal by far is higher quality research. And I can't really emphasize this enough. I mean, we're now routinely doing experiments on order of hundreds of servers, right? This is the equivalent of letting something run on your laptop or on your desktop server overnight a few years ago. The equivalent today is you fire up 100 EC2 nodes and you let it run for a couple of hours. It's really become pervasive. And we've had a number of results and more than one conference paper where the results were reported based on 1,000 or more servers. And that was, for a university, that was just not... That was not even on the radar a few years ago. So this is a qualitatively new thing, and we're really excited about it. And it really does lend a certain credibility to the results, where you could say, yes, we did. We have real workload traces, and we expanded them out to run it on 1,000 machines, and this is what happened. Because, as everyone knows, at 1,000 machines, you get effects that you couldn't get at 100, which gives you effects that you couldn't get at 10. So every order of magnitude increase, something qualitatively different happens, and now we can really observe it. This is really, really cool. We get results faster. This is also, you get results faster because there's more machines. But what wasn't obvious to us is that would allow us to solve fundamentally new kinds of problems. So one example was, we have a lot of machine learning and data mining research going on, as I said. A particular project that I was involved with one of my PhD students is he was looking at console logs from things like the Hadoop file system and Hadoop. And when there were operational problems with Hadoop, the question was, could you do data mining on these console logs, which look like free text, basically, and figure out something useful that would point you to possible sources of the problem? So the short answer is that, yes, you could do that. And an expensive part of the process was combining the console log with the source code of the original program so that you could make inferences about where each of the messages originated. For a variety of reasons, the parsing step was hard. He figured out how to use EC2. So he said, we got all these Amazon credits. If you can parallelize the parsing step, use EC2, and then you can do it in kind of minutes instead of hours. That way you can run more experiments. What we didn't realize is that if you can do it in minutes, then this is no longer an offline tool, it's an online tool, right? You can have a tool that runs a few minutes behind reality, and when something bad happens, the tool might be able to give you insight within a few minutes as to what the problem was. And that's something we just hadn't thought of. So there's a class of problems for which getting results orders of magnitude faster actually changes what you can use your techniques to do. And that was a revelation to us. Okay, so cloud computing saves money. I'll just say that that was a non-goal. That's a nice way of saying we have spent a tremendous amount of money on cloud computing. But you know, if you kind of now ask the question, and I'm just going to put a hypothetical number out there. I'm going to make this up, $75,000. That's a made-up number. I just picked it out of the air randomly. But now if you say, what could we do? Suppose we had spent that same amount of money internally. What could we or couldn't we have done? Well, we could provision $75,000 worth of stuff. But we'd also need a lot more admin time to be able to actually take care of that, so the actual amount of stuff would be less. It would take much longer to provision, and we'd have to make a one-time decision about how much we wanted. We've run some experiments with hundreds of machines and some experiments with thousands of machines, so we couldn't have gotten this pay-as-you-go benefit. So I won't say, we can honestly say we did not get into cloud computing because we believed it would save us money. We got into it because we thought there was interesting research to be done on what the hell is cloud computing good for, but having said that, cloud computing has changed the way that we do research in ways that we hadn't really anticipated. Having said that, there's also some obstacles that we've encountered. None of these have been deal breakers so far, but we could imagine that they easily could be. Accounting models don't currently reward cost-effective cloud use. Even if we could demonstrate that in some sense we'd gotten a lot more computing bang for our buck by spending all this money on Amazon Web Services, it's very difficult for us to convert that into an accounting model where the university would give us some sort of a credit against our general overheads, let's say. And I think that just kind of points back to the problem that IT costs are difficult to tease out. There's all these components that go into it. And while Amazon has done a great job of quantifying what it costs them to rent you a server, you know, in the university setting at least, we have not done nearly as thorough of a job. The flip side of that coin is that the agencies that do funding and to whom you write grants, that culture has not caught up to this concept of CapEx versus OpEx. And for them, this really is the difference. They're used to you asking for money to buy things, and maybe for money to have people who administer and operate and feed the things. But the idea that you're going to have this sort of debit account and pay as you go for what used to be a capital expense, there's no line that you can write that on the grant proposal. And that's slowly changing. In fact, we were able to somehow use some of our NSF money to buy EC2 credits, and I don't remember exactly how we did that. But the funding and grant culture is still a little bit behind, and I think this is going to be one of those cases where they're going to be dragged into it by researchers who, because of the new opportunities, are not going to be able to keep themselves away from using the cloud. The tools for cloud computing are still, they still require what I would call a high degree of sophistication. For an EECS person, it's not a huge learning curve, but I can't imagine that someone in a non-IT savvy department would be able to get the kind of benefits that we've been getting. The sort of off-the-shelf solutions just aren't there yet. There's an attractive role for software appliances. If you can figure out how to create, you know, a software appliance that runs a departmental website or runs a courseware kind of website, that might be a great way to sort of get some of those solutions into departments that are less IT savvy, I guess, than EECS departments typically are. And we have, in fact, run into this obstacle of software licensing not being cost associative. A lot of software licensing is still tied to the number of seats or number of fixed CPUs or the number of software dongles. You know, so we have a pool of MATLAB licenses, and one person can exhaust the pool by basically running a big enough experiment. So that's, you know, part of the solution is we are moving more towards open source, but ultimately there are tools like MATLAB that a lot of EEs rely on, and we have to figure out a solution for that. So let me say a little bit about the actual research we've been doing, because I think, like I said, one of the genuinely new opportunities for cloud computing is this idea that you can scale up and down and that you need some kind of models to tell you when that's an appropriate thing to do and how you should do your provisioning. The motivation for saying this is that you know, prior to cloud computing, most people who worked on performance optimization were looking at systems that we would call pretty small by comparison. So you could do these detailed cost performance models, but the system you were doing them on, there might be enough noise in the model that, you know, really what you were modeling was sort of which of three equivalence classes you were in or something like that. With cloud computing, you can actually collect a lot of telemetry from a lot of machines, and there's an opportunity to actually create models that are much more sophisticated. there is an opportunity to create models that actually talk about an ensemble of things. So instead of saying, this machine here is going to behave this way, you can say things like, the typical machine is going to behave this way. And you start thinking distributionally about the behavior of your clusters. And you know, again, until cloud computing, that really only made sense as an approach if you had a data center that was that large, right? If you were Google or if you were Amazon. But with cloud computing, pretty much any schmo can put up a virtual data center with a couple of thousand machines for not very much money, and all of a sudden you have these problems. So the domain to whom, you know, the domain of users to whom solutions to these problems would apply, we think has been greatly broadened by how inexpensive cloud computing is. So one example of this is, you know, we pointed out that there's an economic reward for scaling down as well as up, for releasing the resources you don't need. And this makes the optimization a little more difficult, especially if the servers you're talking about are not kind of, you know, stateless web servers, but storage servers. So we've been working on a project, you know, along with everybody else who's working on non-relational data storage. We're building a non-relational data store that has a performance-safe query language. For the purposes of the little demo I'm going to show, the lower layer of this, the storage layer of this, is basically wrappers around Berkeley DB. And what we're doing is we're managing a number of different ranges of keys in a key value store. The idea being that if we get a data hotspot, we would like to split off that part of a server, start up a new server. We could replicate data if the spot gets even hotter. And what we would like to do is, based on actual demand, tailor the number of servers that we're using to the actual demand. What's hard about this, of course, given that we're doing this for a storage system, is when you add a server, it implies that you have to move some data over to that server in order for it to be useful. And conversely, when you remove a server, unless the server was just a read-only replica, you probably have to copy some data off of that server so that you don't lose that data when you decommission the server. So I'm going to see if I can get a little movie to work. This is always a risk. The project that this is in the context of is called SCADS, Scalable Consistency Adjustable Data Storage. We had a CIDR paper about it this year. The idea is that we have an indexing system that runs on top of this lower-level key-value store. And in order to model how long different queries are going to take, it would like for the lower level to essentially guarantee as an invariant, I will always complete key-value operations within this SLA, you know, within a bounded amount of time. So if we can get the lower layer to do that, and to do it in an elastic way depending on the workload, then the upper layers actually use the machine learning models to make predictions about how long various queries will take to do and give feedback to the developer saying, you know, you really should add an index here and stuff like that. So we have a prototype of this that's working, and I'll show you this little kind of mini demo so you can kind of get a sense of the elasticity. So here's how this works. What's on the top axis is workload from a real web server. It's from a company called Ebates that we worked with a while ago. It's sort of a, you know, 24 hours worth of load to their web service. The middle is the relative ratio of reads to writes. So kind of down at the lower left corner, it's basically read-only traffic. And there's that hump in the middle where all of a sudden the traffic goes up to being about 50% writes. And a replicated storage system, writes take a lot more work. So they actually, doing a write causes a server to do relatively more by about a factor of 5 than doing a read off of that same server. And then toward the end, it quiesces down to being a read-mostly workload again. What's going on the bottom is that each one of the blue-black line pairs represents a server. We're starting out with only 6 servers, so, you know, 6 vertical bars. Over the course of the demo, it's going to go up to about 32 servers and eventually back down to 5 or 6 because we're going to replay that workload, compressing 24 hours into about 30 seconds, I think, for the purposes of the demo. And what's happening is, if I'm tall enough, which I'm usually not, the height of the blue bar is the percent utilization on each individual server brick. And the dotted red line is the utilization level at which, based on our micro benchmarks, we know that we're in jeopardy of violating the SLA invariant. Right? So essentially, the goal is for the utilization never to get high enough to touch the red line. If that looks like it's going to happen, we need to add a server somewhere. When we add a server, we have to make a decision about where we're going to split the data range of the server that's currently overloaded. So the black bar under each blue bar, the height of the black bar is proportional to what fraction of the key range is being served by that server. The reason that the black bars could be of different heights is that if there's a smaller subset of the key range that's hot, that server will be just as busy serving a smaller subset. And you'll also, as we run time forward, you'll see that some of the bars that appear, instead of being blue, are green. those green bars are straight ahead replicas of the neighboring blue server. So that's the case where even serving a very small range of keys, the hotspot was still bad enough that we needed to replicate even that small range. So if QuickTime works for me, this is always the part that terrifies me. Let me see. Is there a thing for, oh, I get it. My screen's probably the wrong size. Is there play? Surely there's a play button. Okay, hold on. If I reopen it, it'll work. Right? Yes. If I reopen QuickTime Player, it will figure out the right screen size. This worked really well when I was out in the lounge, by the way, so bear with me. Okay. Yes, I can do this. Where's the damn play button? Oh, that worked. Press the space bar. Okay, so I'm sorry you lost the axis on the bottom, but I wish I could put it in like loop mode. But basically, you can see, so as we're going to go to the section where there's a lot of writes happening, and we're going to be adding a whole bunch of servers, and in fact some replicas to cope with how much higher the workload is because we're doing writes instead of reads. As things start to calm down, we sort of coalesce some servers. And so, you know, I'll let you be mesmerized by the demo while I explain kind of what's relevant about this. What's interesting about doing this kind of work is that in a standard load balancing scenario, if I'm going to split a server and move some data off of it, kind of what's the simplest thing you could think of to do? Well, you split the range in half and move half the range over. What's interesting about cloud computing is that if it's really true that you're probably going to have to eventually scale back down, actually what you want to do is copy over the least amount of data that you can get away with and still meet your SLA. Because probably in the future, there will come a time when you don't need that capacity anymore, and now you've got to copy that data back in order to avoid losing it. So it kind of, you know, we figured that it changes the way that we think about load balancing, because what seemed like a straightforward thing to do before, which is, you know, add capacity and then sort of evenly distribute your load over the new capacity, is no longer necessarily the right thing. Right? What you want to do is add just enough capacity to fix your current problem, and in anticipation of the fact that sometime in the future you're going to want to retract that capacity so that you can release it and not pay for it anymore. And that's where it becomes interesting to have machine learning models that can help you make those predictions. So I wish my axes had worked a little better on that, but I think you kind of get the idea. But the main message is that, and this is kind of new for us too, you know, the idea that you can get capacity on demand and the fact that you have a motivation to release the capacity that you're not using means that the right thing to do when you're adding capacity is do the least amount of work that you can get away with up front in anticipation of the fact that you're going to have to undo a lot of that work later. And that wasn't obvious to us a few weeks ago. So we've also experimented with computer science education in the cloud, and this has had kind of a number of really distinct positive impacts. For us, I think one of the best ones has been that we can expose students to a somewhat realistic environment. For example, we have a lab where we ask them, you know, figure out how many web servers it takes to tip over a database. Okay, now turn on various kinds of caching and, you know, figure out how much better did that make things, which things got better and which things didn't get better. A typical answer for this was that we had about 20 project teams simultaneously working on this lab, and it takes order of 10 servers to tip over a MySQL stack with caching enabled, so we would have needed 200 servers on the night the lab was due, right? And again, in a university environment, that's not going to happen, but with EC2, it was a piece of cake. And the same, you know, end-of-term project demos, right? Nothing happens, and bam, the project is due, and everybody is in the lab. Well, now the lab is a cloud computing environment. It's just a bunch of people sitting with laptops trying to get stuff to run remotely. Plus the fact that, you know, we can actually give students a VM image that's got a lot of stuff pre-installed on it to save them some time. Student, if they need to install their own stuff, they can be root. They learn how to use installers. They actually can do things that, you know, experience with a command line that they might not otherwise get. And if they screw something up, we can just reinstantiate from the original class golden image, and everything's good again. By the way, this is also great for, you know, from the point of view of the IT staff who normally are in charge of computing infrastructure. The old way that we would do stuff is we'd say, we're going to teach this class, and we need these 8 packages installed so that students can use them. Right now, we install the 8 packages ourselves, we create a VM image, and we just point the students at it. And it's, you know, I think it's a much, much less strain on the course staff than it would otherwise have been. And it's faster turnaround, because if we decide, oh, we really need to get the latest version of Foo, that's fine. We just update our own VM image with the latest Foo and tell the students to start using that. So that's been pretty cool. So, you know, kind of how would I summarize our experience using cloud computing in the EECS department? We have focused on what new things we can do with it. We've not really focused on cost savings. I think for research, that's entirely appropriate. But again, you know, it reinforces this question of there are potentially many reasons that you might want to consider the cloud. If you're doing R&D, this is a perfectly valid reason that's got nothing to do with cost savings. Other departments that are less technically savvy, you know, their mileage may vary. The tools are still really aimed at people who are quite sophisticated. And there's a lot of what I'll call admino-technical issues, like authentication and permissions and mounting of remote volumes and stuff that are pretty much largely unsolved. I think as EECS researchers, we found that there's a number of problems that we can usefully tackle even without having that problem solved. But I think fundamentally that's going to be a major obstacle in getting academic and R&D stuff going into the cloud. And lastly, the funding and costing models from the agency and university point of view are slowly beginning to catch up. And, you know, that's a good thing, but it'll take some time. So let me kind of retrospect kind of kind of summarize each of the chunks of the talk here. So is there something actually new about cloud computing? Yes, we think there is. We think that this idea of risk transference from the user to the cloud vendor enables fundamentally new scenarios. And some different examples of that are if you're a startup and you have no idea what your demand will be, if you have a lot of one-off tasks that can be cast as an embarrassingly parallel problem, you can exploit this cost associativity, getting a lot of servers for a short time. And you know, in my world, it means that you can actually conduct research and do education at scales that were not only were impossible before, but realistically are the scales that these students are going to have to be comfortable with when they get out into the real world. Can you get improved utilization and lower costs? Yes, you can, but it requires, among other things, that you have a story for scaling down as well as up. And that's both a technical story and it's a policy story. It's a technical story because you have to think about software design in a different way. You know, as I showed with the scalable database, scaling down, you know, it's not just throwing away web servers, right? It can be quite tricky, and it changes the way that you think about load balancing and what's the right amount of work to spread over your new capacity and stuff like that. And having solved the technical issue, you need to have an economic motivation or a pseudo-economic motivation for scaling down. Otherwise, it's not likely that you're going to realize the massively improved utilization that you're potentially hoping for. Various obstacles that we identified to cloud computing, again, more of them are listed in the paper, and we have examples that go into a lot more detail. But one of them is this idea of, you know, what is it that we're choosing to become dependent on if we go into the cloud? And there's different flavors of that. One flavor is it's expensive to move my data. Is it going to get trapped in the cloud? Am I going to not be able to pull it out in a format that I can do something with? The management APIs for different kinds of clouds are not standardized. So, you know, EC2 was sort of early. It's a de facto standard. Eucalyptus is API compatible with it, but Google App Engine is different. Microsoft Azure is quite different. And depending on which kind of cloud you use, you may be just as beholden or more beholden to proprietary software. You know, if you're using Microsoft Azure, there's a bunch of really great services that they provide that your apps can use. But once you become dependent on those services, that changes the equation of how you could shift away from that cloud if, for some reason, the relationship went sour. Software licensing is still a big issue, although we've seen that, you know, companies as prominent as IBM are taking steps to make their licensing practices somewhat more cloud-friendly. Security and IT best practices become a real issue. You're choosing to put stuff into a public cloud, so now all those things that, you know, maybe some of your users were letting slide, the penalty for letting slide just got a lot higher. So, you know, I guess one of the questions we got is, do you guys really think that there's, you know, in your paper, you don't really talk very much about security in the cloud. Is that because you think there are no new security problems? I would say that there are probably some new security problems. In fact, there's a really interesting guy, Aaron Tromer at MIT, who is looking at things like, if you can get your VM co-located with someone else's VM on the same physical hardware, what new side channel attacks can you do? and he's come up with some pretty wacky stuff. So I think there probably are some new security issues, but they're not where the initial pain is going to be. The initial pain is stuff that we sort of already have trouble getting people to do right, and now it's become that much more critical that they be able to do so. And in fact, if you're in it for the money, how are you going to quantify the savings? Can you unbundle all of the IT costs so that you could do a real apples-to-apples comparison between public cloud, private cloud, and just doing what you're doing now? And lastly, the idea that the locus of administration is now much more diffuse. So you have stuff going over public networks, you're using somebody else's storage, there's issues of liability, and as I said, you know, our UC Berkeley CIO is a very, very sharp guy. He knows all about the technical benefits of why UC Berkeley should look more at cloud computing, but this is the kind of thing that keeps him up at night, is, you know, what don't you want appearing on the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle? So, should you cloudify? Well, it depends. If you expect to save money, don't expect the economy of scale that Amazon gets, unless you're them or comparably large. It's more likely that you'll realize savings because of better utilization, but again, not to beat on a dead horse, in order to get the better utilization, you have to be able to do resource accounting and use that resource accounting to give people a reason to release what they're not using. And if you ever get a chance to hear Oliver and Oliver Ratzenberger from eBay has a fascinating talk about how they do analytics as a service inside eBay, and he talks about this some. And you can consider whether hybrid or search computing makes sense. Maybe there's a subset of what you're doing that kind of sidesteps a lot of the immediate obstacles and lets you get some value out of the cloud right away. And even if you decide not to move to the cloud, it's a useful driver to make you take a good look at some of these questions, right? Enforcing best practices, identifying what the true costs of supporting IT are, and even if you don't move to the cloud, it may be a good exercise to go through and try to do this, as we've been trying to do at Berkeley. So, in conclusion, is cloud computing entirely hype? No, we think there's actually something new here. Is it, you know, just this fad and in a few months it'll be gone? We think this is a real thing. We think that I hate using words like paradigm shift. I'm not sure that sea change is any better. But I don't think that we're going to go back to a non-cloud computing world. I think that the number of new things you can, independent of the money-saving aspect, the number of new things and the kinds of innovation you can get by making sort of instantaneous large capacity available to more or less anybody with a Visa card, there are too many opportunities to say that this is going to fizzle out. So we think that this is, you know, 5 years from now at Lisa, we're still going to be talking about cloud computing. It's just the problems will be different ones. Should you cloudify? Is it for everyone? Depending on who you ask, either no or not yet. But in any case, it's good to understand, you know, if it's not a good solution for you, what are the specific obstacles that are keeping you from doing it? Or, you know, could you technically do it, but the truth is the money is just not going to be there? And my hope is that with some of the obstacles and, you know, the way we've tried to lay out the framework here will assist you if you are ever on the receiving end of that kind of a conversation. So we encourage you to visit our website. You guys have been great, but I guess you're just waiting for the end to start hurling tomatoes, and I thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Mark Burgess from Oslo University College and CF Engine. This resource management problem I think is very interesting, and you say it's an interesting research problem. I've actually worked on this for about 10 years, the provisioning of or adapting to changes, the elasticity, and CF Engine does a little bit of this. What I see is that you really have to be able to separate the fluctuations in your load from the average, local average, and the key to that is the ability to separate scales, and that usually means weak coupling between the components of the system. Things that drive each other very strongly tend to lead to system behavior that goes out of control, and you're trying to keep away from this kind of 70% margin on queues so that you never approach queues that go out of control and so on. So I think software writing strategy could be, this could be a key point, getting people to design software in a particular way, which is weakly coupled components. Do you have any ideas or comments about that?
I do, and it's a great observation. Let me kind of say back to you a part of what you said, and tell me if I'm representing it correctly, that one of the ways to manage this issue of highly variable resources is a prerequisite is having a sufficiently modular design that you don't have things whose behavior is tightly coupled to each other. In other words, you want a pretty well-defined and narrow contractual interface between what are otherwise separate modules. So I completely agree with that. And in fact, Although, you know, for lack of time, I have a bunch of backup slides, by the way. So when these get posted to the Lisa site, you can look at some backup slides. The larger project of which the demo that I showed is a part is designed exactly along those lines. So that we have this higher layer that worries about questions like, you have this complicated query that amounts to a multi-table join, and I want to try to have a model for how long it takes in terms of primitives to do that query. But that only works because we have this lower level that is basically guaranteeing I can do primitives very consistently. And the way that it makes the guarantee of how it does the primitives consistently is by using this active elastic adaptation to say, don't worry, I'll keep the average latency below 25 milliseconds. Don't worry about how I do it. But that's, you know, my contract is a performance contract as well as a software API contract. So I think you're right, but I don't know that most people are designing their software that way.
Right.
And I think one thing that's going to drive it is if you look at Amazon is already providing services like S3 and SimpleDB and CouchDB and stuff like that. And these are basically services that try to do the same thing. They have a narrow contractual interface, and they try pretty hard to give you a consistent performance profile. I think what that means is de facto, people are going to start writing modules, you know, on the other side of that boundary, and they'll get used to having that. So I think that there will be the culture of writing software that knows how to adapt in this way will slowly start picking up speed. And, you know, we're hoping with machine learning to sort of ride the front edge of that wave. But, you know, I know a lot of other people are doing great stuff in that space as well.
And, you know, my interest has always been applying the methods of physics to these problems because I'm a physicist originally.
That sounds really hard.
No, it's not as hard as you think. I was writing about this kind of elasticity in 2003, and I've done some work on it, as I say. But as you, I mean, what you said was really important at the beginning, that it's all about the scale and this decoupling of things from each other. The sensitivity to that coupling decreases with the scale of the overall system. So, you know, the bigger these clouds get, the less sensitive things are and the more predictable these things become. So
that's the hope. Very good points.
Alpha Couch Tufts University. I have a specific concern with trust. I'm not sure I agree with you that things will be ubiquitous. I have seen so far a pattern of trusting clouds for public data, but dire concerns on privacy. And I'm wondering if, in your opinion, the economy of scale for clouds will win out over the trust problem for privacy.
So I think the question is, ultimately, will the lure of economy of scale be enough to overcome what are currently serious concerns about sensitive data being stored in a public cloud, and who do you trust? So great question. I think I hate to prognosticate on this matter, but since you give me no choice, I'm going to, I suppose, do so anyway. Purely from a non-technical point of view, I think the U.S., well, legislation has always been behind technology in the U.S., and I think this is an area where not only is legislation behind technology, legislation is behind, for example, what the EU is doing. Right, there are much stricter data privacy standards and you know, legal frameworks and stuff like that already in place. And I think, like a lot of security-related problems in computer science, the answer to your question is not going to end up being a purely economic answer. Right? It can't be a purely economic answer if it turns out to be illegal to move certain kinds of data into a public cloud absent, you know, some certain strong guarantees. Now, there is a third scenario, which I think we haven't talked about, which is essentially one or more companies getting into the business of providing a private cloud, or a virtualized private cloud that actually has heavy auditing in place, that is set up to be transparent with respect to all these regulatory frameworks like HIPAA and FERPs and all these other things. And I actually think that that's an area where there's a real opportunity in that area. I can imagine some company becoming essentially a trusted but verified guardian of some of the sensitive data, and that could be a separate infrastructure that is sort of at arm's length from the public cloud. But I agree with you that the public cloud, as we now know it, is going to be a non-starter for a lot of that kind of data.
Mario Bejas, Raytheon. Quick question. This is a sort of like a non-technical one. On commercial licenses, you mentioned MATLAB, things like that. So you have some fairly large cost licenses. Sometimes these licenses have buried wacko restrictions, you can't be more than 30 miles away, et cetera. And so, you know, when you start looking at your portfolio of things that you'd like to possibly move into the cloud, and you have to examine all those, I was just wondering, you guys must have gone through very similar things, and wonder if you had any lessons learned for, are there certain licenses that just, yeah, no way can work this in this model, or things to look out for? Just anything you can talk a little more about.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of licenses that, you know, like the MATLAB license, at least the kind that we have, just doesn't work in this model. Fortunately, the people at MATLAB like us, so maybe we'll be able to work something out. But I'll be perfectly blunt. I don't have any positive experience to share with you on this. You know, I think the only positive thing I can say is that, you know, if, you know, IBM steps up to the plate and says, okay, we're going to take our, you know, very high-profile web software and we're going to make that available on a pay-as-you-go basis. Now, never mind the fact that what they're actually charging for it is, in my opinion, quite high. It's the fact that they recognize that there's a business opportunity in making their licensing model match the resource consumption model. So, you know, I think the only thing I can really hope for is that other companies will see that if they don't do that, MATLAB's a great program, but I can imagine someone coming along to eat its lunch.
Okay, so I think you're kind of telling me that collectively, if all of us who are having this interest kind of have to go to our each individual vendor and say, you know, I'd like to do this, and can you add my weight to the number of people who would like to do this?
It would be great if there were a centralized mechanism for this, you know, like there'd be a wiki or something where you could go sign your name as, yes, I think MATLAB should support pay-as-you-go licensing. Okay. That would be a great idea.
All right, thank
you. In fact, if you set that up, let us know.
Just a quick follow-up on that. It seems as though Amazon and Google and the providers of this kind of service have the opportunity for tremendous leverage against, like, leverage on providers like MATLAB and so on, to get them to think about changing their licensing so that they can work in that area.
That'd be good.
They need users to also go and say, yeah, that's right. If you change your licensing so that I can buy a certain number of CPU hours of MATLAB time, that would be great. But the fulcrum of that leverage is, or the length of the lever arm is Google or Amazon or whoever, saying, look, I've got thousands of customers out there. I've got millions of customers out there, and they all want to have the ability to buy a few hours of MATLAB time.
So, so short answer, yes, I agree. I think that, you know, the companies that are these high volume providers potentially could have a lot of leverage. And you kind of see this with Amazon already with the Kindle owners. Anybody? Kindle owners? Okay, maybe not. Maybe it's just me. They already have a thing where if there's a book you want to buy and it's not available on the Kindle, you can click a button and it adds your name to a list of people who have requested, I would love to read this book on my ebook reader. And I think it would be great if there was, you know, the equivalent for EC2. Here's all these applications that people want to run. Click here to add your name to a petition, and, you know, we'll be, you know, emailing the MATLAB guys once a month. I think This is my opinion, not backed by any research, what I'm about to say. I think of the current cloud providers, Amazon is the most likely to be able to do that, just because the culture they come from, they've gotten really good at making you want to buy things, right? They have figured out how to, they've monetized, you know, how to show you books that you might like based on books that you've seen, and, you know, you could read reviews, and they have all these tie-ins that are aimed at sort of getting you one step closer to clicking the buy it now button. And part of it has been their relationship with publishers and content providers. So if they could figure out a way to, you know, to harness that machine to work with software licensors and say, we have a way to track the number of users who would pay this much money today for pay-as-you-go licenses, I think that next time I see Werner, I'll talk to him about it. But that's a great idea.
Okay, thanks very much, Andrew.
Thank you, guys. You've been great.